I'm Jim Haskell, editor of the Bridgewater Daily Observations, and once again, I'm coming to you from Singapore. It's been since last April that I sat down with Ray Dalio, Bridgewater's founder and CIO mentor, to get his update on how he's applying his five big forces to current circumstances in the markets today. We're going to do so again now, but we're going to do it from a very unique location. I am coming to you from the Ocean Explorer. This is Ray's vessel that he uses for all the scientific research where he engages in his second passion, which is the ocean. So it is a unique opportunity to not only explore Ray's views on markets today through his updated five big forces, but to do it from this location. We hope you enjoy. So Ray, it's so good to be here. I mean, it's quite a unique setting and to share these dual passions you have, ocean exploration through OceanX, and of course, markets, economies, world affairs with you. So thank you so much for having me here in Singapore. I really appreciate it.
Well, it's great to have you on the ship. And this is a big initiative of mine, which is great, but it's also one of a number of philanthropic initiatives, of a lot of different things that excite us. But I'm glad this is particularly exciting.
We were just walking down. There was a lab where you can examine species DNA live here. I mean, it seems like incredible cutting edge research. And we're going to include links in this video to all of that for any of our viewers that are interested in pursuing that more.
Great.
So let's talk a little bit about the markets. Last time we talked was in April. A lot has happened, global affairs, a lot's happened with the economy and markets, certainly in the late July and August timeframe. But one of the things that you taught me, you know, is one of the big things I sort of learned at Bridgewater, is that it's really important to have a framework at the highest level that you then apply to the current circumstances, to try and weigh those forces, and that kind of helps you judge what you think is most probabilistic. And your framework, which you published in your book, you know, Principles for a Changing World Order, is really five. I want to just briefly say what they are, but I want you to go, you know, through them, and then let's start to apply them to today's current circumstances. So the first one is sort of the economy, debt, money, markets. The second one, I'll call it internal order or conflict, so order or disorder, and that's a very relevant topic today. The third one, external order or disorder, you know, the great power rivalries and so on. The fourth one, this notion of climate, you know, pandemic. Acts of nature. And then a fifth one that you added is technology, you know, and a lot to talk about with respect to AI.
Yeah, these are the five forces that they all really came to light through my examination of the last 500 years of history. And so all of them sort of came together. You could see how they work together.
And then just to be clear, when you're applying these five forces, And coming up with, you know, how you're seeing the markets today, you're weighing the significance of each of those against each other and sort of netting out. Is that correct?
Well, yeah. Think of it as that they're currents, okay, and that they coincide, generally speaking. For example, if you have a debt crisis, then you probably have an internal order crisis because of money and the impact. And then that relates to an external order conflict. So these cycles tend to go together. And then, as you say, there's number four is the weather, the impact of climate and those types of things. And then through it all is man's inventiveness. In other words, that keeps rising at various paces, but that notion of evolution toward higher levels, which is the fifth force, technology in particular.
All right, so let's go into them and, you know, get your views on how you're looking at them today, and then we can net that out into, you know, the most probabilistic path going forward.
Okay, we see these cycles, and the cycles really are almost marked by wars, you know, because at the ending stage, you have a war. And then you have a lot of destruction, writing down debt and so on, and you begin. So you can follow this cycle starting really at the end of World War II, right? So what you have in the beginning is internal order, productivity, and so on. But over a period of time, debt rises relative to incomes. And debt is money. One man's debt's another man's money. And as that rises over a period of time, there's a lot of borrowing, and then that produces a economic and cycle related to borrowing, the great wave in a sense. And of course, that carries a lot. So we have that cycle late in a cycle. You have a lot of debt relative to income. Debt is one man's buying power. Mm-hmm. And so there is an issue there. Okay, that's part of the cycle. Through that uprise, you also have increased gaps in wealth. And, you know, that's the nature of the cycle. So it distinguishes, but these large wealth gaps enter into the picture. And so you see internal conflict that starts to emerge. So that's why you see in the 30s, you see four civil wars. I won't go through them, but basically that conflict, when those are both happening together, usually the internal conflict then precedes number three, which is the external conflict. In other words, there's a great power conflict in the world. Once there's a winner of a war, there's a dominant power. And then there's order for the reasons I described. But over a period of time, that dominant power may lose relative power to other powers. And as a result, there is a great power conflict during this period of disruption, when you have economic problems combined with then the political problems that I'm describing internally, political and social problems. Okay, so those are the three that really make a big cycle. We can call that the big cycle. That big cycle will vary, but it typically is a lifetime, something like 80 years, roughly speaking, but it varies. Okay, not necessarily cyclical is weather and climate and so on. Because what's interesting is droughts, floods, and pandemics have cost people, the world, more lives than wars. And so it is a big force that comes along. So we could see how that affected in the 30s. It's certainly a big force now. And then, of course, number five is man's inventiveness, new technologies, right? And so today we see it, I think, a greater force from that than anything, because it's all thinking. So as we're dealing with artificial intelligence, it's the thinking and the application of everything. So those five forces, in terms of the interactions, you can track most of what's happening with those five forces. And I think it's very important to step back and look at it in that light, because I think people tend to look at everything event by event by event, and they don't put it into that context. So when we look at it, do we have a debt money issue? What does that look like? Do we have an internal political issue? That internal political issue, when it gets bad, means irreconcilable differences, conflicts. Okay, what is it like internationally? Do we have world order or do we have a world power struggle? What is that like? So that is the template that we're referring to. Then we can jump into those and then look at the particulars and exactly where we are.
You've long said we're on a path that we're over indebted, and that, you know, the ability to get out of debt, either you go through an ugly deleveraging or you go through a beautiful deleveraging. We actually went through that after the global financial crisis. You know, I think the policy was engineered to go through a beautiful deleveraging and largely engineered that way. And then the pandemic occurred and we had the stimulus that created inflation, higher interest rates, and interestingly, not as much sensitivity, I think, because that debt was in the public sector. How are you looking at the debt dynamics today?
Classically, the private sector gets more and more indebted, and the public sector, particularly governments with central bank supports, take on the debt. So what we've seen is the government debt rise a lot.
Yeah.
So the economy is less sensitive to that because the government is taking on the debt, and the central bank is supporting that effort in one way or another, right?
Yep.
So what we see is still that pattern in terms of the rising debt to GDP. And of course, that's caused the issues that we have now with inflation and other influences. So we're still seeing on a cyclical basis, total debt relative to GDP continuing to rise near its high. And then we deal with the debt service cost, which is a function of interest rates. So as the central bank puts the money, tightens the money, and then starts to squeeze the economy in a very classic way, then you see the economy slow up as that debt service, and then you go through the other leg of the cycle. So there are these short-term cycles, which we call recessions and expansions. There have been 12 and a half. We're now halfway through the short-term debt cycle. So that's the power. While the government then takes on that responsibility because it has the greater capacity. Let's say if the central bank loses money, it doesn't appear to be a problem in the early stages. Later stages, it can become a problem. So I think when you look at it, Japan is a very good example of this, right?
Because Japan has far more government debt, you know, as a percentage of their economy than we do in the United States. But they basically manage that at the price of a very devalued exchange rate.
Debt, one man's debt is another man's asset. That has declined by about 90%.
Right.
If I'm holding a debt asset in Japanese yen, it has declined in value by about 90% relative to a U.S. Interest rate in terms of the real depreciation, 90%. Mm-hmm. So what a tremendous loss of wealth in terms of writing down that debt in that cyclical way. It's the accumulation of the foreign exchange rate and the interest rate differences.
Right.
In other words, there's been about an average of about 3% interest rate differences.
Right.
So over 15 years, those 3% add up to a lot, right? Then you also have the depreciation of the exchange rate. So it's both the interest rate differential and the depreciation of the exchange rate.
During this period, in the last decade and more, really, I mean, you could say it's much longer, the U.S. has outperformed, you know, there's been cycles, but the U.S. has outperformed in a real economy sense, and certainly the markets have outperformed. But our debt is growing. So we just talked about Japan. Is the U.S. poised for a similar type of loss of wealth? Is that the inevitable outcome, even if it's managed well? Or is there some other path that is still attainable right now in the U.S. to get us onto a better fiscal standing?
I think it's important to understand that the debt assets, even for the United States, which was the better place to have debt assets, was losing. The debt assets were losing. They lost to inflation. They lost in nominal bond terms. You lost money. Mm-hmm. The relative loss of the value of money and debt in Japan was much greater, but they all lost money. And now, as we're going forward, the issue is really, you know, there's too much debt, and one way or another, it has to be marked down, and you're not going to default on the debt. So there will be a marking down of the real return of that debt, I believe. That's the classic cycle.
Mm-hmm. When you look at the U.S. position relative to the rest of the, let's say, developed world, because everyone's basically got a debt problem, are you more optimistic? I know you're going to have some thoughts on the politics and so on, and that's the internal order or disorder and how that could affect this. But when you look around, U.S. productivity is higher than what we see in Europe. You know, it's pretty good on a relative basis.
That's right. So I'm describing there are five forces, I say,
right.
Okay?
Yep.
That last force, which I'm talking about productivity, in other words, the advances in technology and productivity, that other force, is a very big positive force. If you look at the five forces, the debt money force, that's a negative for wealth. If you look at the internal order and disorder force, okay, that's a threat in various ways, taxes, politically, and so on. You look at the external order and disorder force, that's a problem. But if we look at and climate and the impact of that is very, very costly, about $8 trillion a year in a world economy that is $100 trillion a year.
Right.
So it's a big, expensive thing. Those four forces are problems, are difficulties ahead. But we have the most amazing technological breakthroughs. And so I think as we think about how the impact, this other force for productivity is a great, great positive force, although it can be, it depends how it's used, you know? Mm-hmm. You use the technology, it can be a two-edged sword, but the impact in terms of productivity. So I think the real question is that impact. So where the United States is succeeding very well, and this is a real plus, is through that. However, when we look at that, keep in mind that basically it is 1.5 million people out of 333 million people, mm-hmm, that are in that sector. that are leading that way. And half of them are immigrants. And so what we have is this amazing dichotomy between those who are in that part of the inventiveness with the unicorns and everything. And at the same time, we have this massive population that, let's call it the 60%, the lower 60%. And so that creates this internal political force.
Let me relate force one and force five, which is this incredible boom in productivity that we could maybe in the midst of related to artificial intelligence, and the concentration that you're talking about of the wealth in that area, right? For those that are in that sector and know how to do that, doesn't that almost inevitably mean that at some point you're almost going to have broader taxation or higher taxation? Because if you don't share that wealth—
Of course, it's the classic cycle. It's the power and threat of capitalism. Mm-hmm. The capitalism distinguishes the most productive. This is particularly important now in our technological age. A limited number of people can have the most productivity. That's where it's coming from. And this vast majority don't. And so the capitalism rewards that and so on and creates the wealth gaps. And then that becomes generational. The children of those who are the wealthy get the better education and so on. This has happened through history, but this is really a classic one of those. And that's the set of circumstances that we're in. Don't look at averages.
Okay,
averages are misleading.
But I want to make sure we all understand this point. In this world in which we have such a new technology, you're talking about Force 5, where that can, and it's so concentrated that the averages are completely misleading because when you have that wide dispersion of the winners and the losers, averages are meaningless.
Including those technologies replace the people, and so that there's the, they are by definition, or dividing.
Yeah.
And yes.
Okay. So let's talk a little bit about the internal order. We're having these populist and extreme or more extreme forces. Let me put it that way. More extreme political forces pretty much all over the world now. But of course, in the US, we have this election coming up. And I don't really want to get into the politics per se, but I do want to get into your assessment of how, whether like last time we talked, you were very worried about the polarization and the extremes, and I'm presuming that that's only gotten worse, not better.
If you watch these cycles, I laid it out in my book, mm-hmm. Okay, The Changing World Order. It's like there is a diagram practically that you can follow, and it's following that diagram, mm-hmm. Right? As you have greater polarity, you have less compromise, you have a win at all cost mentality. Okay, now there's no compromise, and you're having that in a deteriorating environment, and so that's what you're talking about.
Right.
Okay.
Right. Is your biggest
at the same time as this productivity miracle is happening to one and tending to exacerbate that. I mean, I don't want to say anything in a black and white sense. There are always little parts of this, but by and large, that's what the picture looks like.
Let's go to, the other thing, we have a very messy world. So now I'm in on force three, which is the external order or disorder. We've talked, I think there are two areas to explore here. One is we've talked a lot about the great rivalry between the US and China, and you know China very well. Assess where we are in that rivalry and whether, that's abated somewhat or gotten even worse relative to where it's been.
There are the two sides, and then there are the neutral. So, and then in a war, in a conflict of the sort that we're having, fortunately hasn't been military of the major powers, but we have other powers in conflict. What you see is there at the end of the day, there are the winners, the losers, and the neutral countries. The winners lose.
The losers lose
mm-hmm. terribly. The neutral country are the real winners. And so you could see that dynamic playing out. Okay? You're seeing essentially a war, and at the same time, you're seeing then the neutral powers, the ones that are not involved. So you're seeing India, ASEAN countries, and so on, come up and flourish because they're at the part of their cycles, economic cycles, mm-hmm. when they have enough money to have capital formation. You know, there's a cycle for development. I think there are four stages, okay? When you're a poor country and you can't have any capital formation because you don't have the money to have capital formation, you're poor and you recognize you're poor. When you get enough money that you can have capital formation, that you can build roads, that you can have other forms of capital formation and improve yourself, that state of mind, when you know you're poor, means that you don't waste that money. You put that into productive uses. And so you're seeing building of infrastructure and so on. You're seeing that happen in a number of countries, in India, in Indonesia, into the countries that I did that survey of what countries are going to grow
which
the most.
We just published that.
Yeah. So you see that's the takeoff point, okay? And they're when they have neutral countries geopolitically, that is a very good situation. Then there's that rise. So the second stage is you're getting richer, but you still think you're poor. You have that mentality. Third stage is that you're getting richer and you start to realize that you can enjoy life and you don't have to work 6 days a week and so on. And then you begin to enjoy life more. And so you're still rich, but you start to realize you're rich. And that's the mentality. Then you go to the next stage in which you start becoming poor and you start to think of yourself as rich. So you're borrowing the money and you're living on living standards. And because you're the rich guy, they lend you the money, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. So if we're looking at these emerging countries, many of these emerging countries that are neutral in this conflict and that are also at these takeoff points so that they can have capital formation and so on, you're seeing them like India, like Indonesia, some of the ASEAN countries, mm-hmm. that they are doing well while the other countries are in this conflict. The United States is doing very well for the inventiveness, of course, and the productivity, terrific. And at the same time, it has its other issues that we've just talked about.
And you can see that in the U.S. stock market breakdown because the AI-themed stocks are far outperforming. And then but I think what you're saying, the takeaway is like as an investor, you really want to be looking at those countries that are getting richer, but they don't know that they're richer yet. And so they're doing the high ROI types of projects and expanding that wealth in a sense.
Well, in a threatening world economy.
In a threatening world economy where they're basically neutral.
The neutral countries will do the best if they have the other elements, you know, fundamentally. Are you earning more than you are spending?
Yeah.
Do you have a good income statement and balance sheet? Do you have internal order or disorder? Mm-hmm. How are you working together? How is it? Is it competitive, harmonious, productive, or not? Mm-hmm. And number three, are you at risk of an international war? Mm-hmm. If I look at those countries that are productive and, you know, those are the places that by and large you want to be. The challenge for the world now is that the capital markets in those are not the same. So we have to talk also about portfolio diversification.
Yeah.
Because when we can talk also about what's good and what's bad, but the most important thing is to be able to diversify a portfolio well. Even good places, if they become expensive or not, are good, not good investments.
Right.
So the first thing is know how to diversify well, okay? Second thing, in my opinion, is not be too much in debt assets, okay? So because of this debt issue that I think will probably over a period of time have to be marked down, mm-hmm. right? So I think, and then keep in mind the risks that are also geopolitical and those kinds of things. So be in places that are more neutral to these, that those would be the better places. Now it becomes more challenging because as you have to focus in that, it's not the good old days. That doesn't mean don't have money in the United States, But think about the tech stocks. Tech stocks have been, you know, great investments. Don't concentrate on tech stocks. Okay. I'm not trying to say, okay, run and go do that. As I think about it, for example, I think about what are the ones that are assets that are going to be diversifying well. How much inflation index bonds do you have? I particularly like leveraged inflation index bonds to balance. Do you have any gold in your portfolio? Where, what is your security? So to balance should have no bias. So as your starting point with these things considered.
Yeah. So again, pulling back, looking at the five forces, netting them out, and then going to the principles of how do I create a great portfolio? I think, let me just talk back what I think I heard. You're saying, look, you're not saying don't be invested in the United States. The United States has a lot going for it. You're not even saying don't be invested in places, other developed countries around the world that may have issues. You're saying, remember, you have to have a diversified portfolio because you have to absorb blows that you can't foresee coming. And even in the best investments, you have a range of outcomes. One way to do that is to look at countries at the proper stage of development that are also neutral, you know, in this global conflict, and that give you, you know, an appropriate sense of diversification. You're also saying look at the types of investments. So if you want to be diversified against inflation, inflation index bonds are one way to do that. Gold potentially,
and real rates.
And real rates, right?
You see, when you're owning an inflation index bond, if the real rate goes down, then you get it appreciates. So not only do you have inflation accrual, but you also have the decline in the real rate causes the price to rise.
But that's also at a time when the, you know, central banks are reversing course and cutting rates. So that's a very important point, because you would get that real rate compression, and you get the inflation
without credit risk.
Without credit risk, because it's the government's obligation, right? And that actually, it's not, you can't, and they can't monetize that away in the same.
That's right.
Right, because that would result in inflation, and
that's
you
right.
get that.
That's right. And then when you also put in an element of gold, there's not a credit issue, you know, and there's not, gold is the asset that the one, in a sense, wants to own when there is a question of owning the value of money. Money is debt.
Yeah.
You hold.
Yeah.
Debt is how you hold money. So when you have that set of circumstances, just from a tactical point of view, leveraged inflation index bonds, not so they're high, having a high volatility, but leverage inflation index bonds and gold diversify themselves without credit risk.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, this is not something that people do.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
But if you look at the structure and behavior, and I'm not saying put a lot of money like, oh, run out and go do this. I'm saying, okay, when you think about how to diversify your portfolio without credit risk, okay, then when we deal with tech stocks and so on, there's so much concentration in those tech stocks and so much uncertainty. I've been through dot-com bubbles and so on.
Mm-hmm.
We can find ourselves in one of those. So it's not mean pile into those, okay? Have some of those. But the point is, how do you maintain a real return, a positive real return in that environment that also has threats that are not just market threats, they're taxation threats, they're foreign exchange threats, those kinds of things.
I asked you about the China-U.S. kind of great power rivalry, but there's also a lot of other things going on. We have a continuing war in the Middle East where Iran is a major power working with Russia, who's working with China, and so on. Do you see this as one big sort of axis? Maybe comment a little bit about how you're seeing those other powers and whether they're significant in your thinking.
First, in the general sense, this is very typical of the great power conflicts, that period that I'm talking about, like prior to wars. You don't have a dominant power which is ruling the way you do after World War II or after a war, you have a dominant power. So I think when we're looking at it, we have to see that that's an important element. It's an important element, not just in terms of you can have a violent war, but that you're having a type of war that has big economic implications. In other words, making profits, or the classic motivations are of secondary importance now relative to security. So when one thinks about markets and thinks about economies, one has to put right near the top of the list the geopolitical influences on those things, isolation. And so in this conflict, for example, with this internal political conflict and the external political conflict, we're seeing a difficult dynamic to operate in that environment for doing deals.
Right.
Because what happens is one country, the United States, let's say, wants to have a policy and wants to enter into a deal. I've seen these things that they'll say this company, it would be good if the company entered into the deal, they receive the blessings and everything's okay. And then another party will say, oh, you're fraternizing with the enemy, or you're doing this, because one political party views the friend of the opposition as an enemy. Right. And now we're doing this in a time, think about it, where who is going to run things? Okay, here we come into elections. Like, imagine a foreign power trying to deal with the United States, trying to do a deal. You don't know the regulations. You don't know who's going to be in power. You're going to have this great change. So this element of geopolitics that we're talking about, and the sides lining up, and even the instability in these countries, there's an element of instability in a number of these countries.
Yeah.
This does not lend itself to order.
And order is the thing you need for
it's
productivity,
the
growth, it's the
foundation,
right.
Harmony, right? Broad-based prosperity. Do you have broad-based prosperity and harmony, okay, unity? Or do you have so much fighting and financial problems? We're in an environment of fighting and financial problems, of gaps in wealth, but also gaps in that produce conflicts, right? This is our environment. So when we look at the good things, which is the productivity miracles and so on, and we say, okay, how's that doing for the whole and not represented? Okay, it's really great for some, but we're now in, let's not lose sight of what that overall environment looks like. Order. Are we going to have good governance?
Yeah.
Look at the sides.
Yeah. So, Ray, the earth continues to get hotter. We continue to have more violent storms. Where are you on climate? You talked about the $8 trillion a year. But maybe you could just expand a little bit on how you're seeing this order and the importance of this order.
Climate is, you could put a price tag on it, 8 trillion, 8% of GDP. That's one way of looking at it. It's a good measure of the severity of it. But it's going to be a big factor, and it's not going to be a plus. So it's going to cause, particularly in the global south, which has large populations, it's going to cause problems. It's going to cause migrations and so on. So the way I look at it is you have the first, the debt money one, economic one is a threatening one.
Mm-hmm.
The internal conflict of irreconcilable differences in populism is a problem. The external conflict, let's hope there's caution. Number four is the climate one. It's a problem. And then number five, of course, is the technology. So the first four of those are not good,
right,
and worsening. And then, so that's climate.
And one last question here. Does the power of the fifth, of artificial intelligence, have the, when you look at that and the sheer impact it can have, can it be such a powerful force for the good to overwhelm some of the negatives of the other four?
Put it this way. The most powerful force is how we are with each other.
Yeah.
Okay? That's the most powerful force. Because collectively, we have more wealth, we have more productivity than we've ever had. We're smarter, the world is at a higher living standard, and so on.
Yeah.
So the most powerful force is harmony and how we are with each other. the greatest threat is fighting for oneself. It's human nature. It's animal nature. Mm-hmm. Okay. But at the end of the day, productivity can do it, but it can also destroy us in the ways where now we can, because we're fighting in our own self-interest, we have the best technologies to do that.
Yeah. I want to sort of conclude here with a question about, you know, you started on the floor of the New York Stock Exchange, and you've depicted that in many different interviews and publications. And you also, you talk a lot of things about surprises along the way. So this arc of so many decades now in the markets, how do you think about where we are today relative to all the different kinds of environments? I mean, you say that it's another one of those, but it seems like today's world is really complicated. There's a lot of different parts of those forces that are going on at the same time, simultaneously. Maybe that's to be expected, but in your practical live-through lifetime, is this one of the more complex periods that you've ever encountered?
I don't think it's more complex. I think it is more screwed up, mm-hmm. okay? And more screwed up in a way that if you take these big cycles, if you go back and your history is through the ups and the downs and through the wealth gaps and the wars, mm-hmm. and you go through these cycles and so on, it is like that. And it's not very complicated, okay? Like it comes down to these five forces.
Right.
Okay. And so if you see where are you with these five forces and there's relationships between these five forces and you see that, I think you have to say, okay, I think I'm here. And then when you say, I think I'm here, you also could say, maybe I'm wrong. Okay. So what do I do in order to structure a portfolio well that it doesn't make a difference? Mm-hmm. Okay. And that's what I'm talking about. Because when I look at these things, you know, we could say it's more complicated. I don't think so. I think we pay too much attention to the complexity of it, and we lose sight of the simplicity of the nature of those five forces and the relationships. Mm-hmm. So I think the understanding of history and where are we, yeah. and paying attention, like it's crazy. What is going on in the United States is crazy, yeah. right? Okay, and it's threatening, and it is populism of these extremes with the deterioration, the wealth gap, and the deterioration of cities and those types of things. So you can see that kind of, and if you follow it with the charts in the book, you can see these arcs. So, and then you have to say, well, maybe I'm wrong. Okay, so how do you structure that portfolio? You know, how do you achieve elements of balance? And then you move to your tactical moves from there, like, when there's an oversupply of debt and more debt, one man's assets is another man's liabilities in terms of debt, when there's an overabundance of that and you're not going to get a good real return, mm-hmm. okay, then you might make a tactical shift, particularly if you know where the cycle is.
Yeah.
That's how I think you have to look at it.
Ray, thank you so much. We'll bring it to a close here. It certainly won't be our last discussion, but thank you so much for having us here.
Thank you. It's been a treat. It's been a journey together. Right. Thank you.
Thank you.